A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to On Brand with Alf and me, Rory Sutherland. Each month I'll be talking to household names as well as challenger brands about success, challenges and future opportunities in advertising, marketing and media. And today I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Rachel Eyre, who's the Chief Customer and Marketing Officer at Morrisons. Now, 125 years ago, an egg and butter merchant called William Morrison launched the business in Bradford. Now Morrisons is the fourth largest supermarket chain in the UK, continuing the Market Street legacy. Morrisons has almost 500 stores across the country with 9 million customers visiting each week and covers 97% of the UK through its online delivery service. And this year, Morrisons is launching a number of innovative customer loyalty schemes such as My Points Booster and expanding its own in-store retail media. Here to share more is Rachel. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Rory.
So, tell us a bit more. First of all, I think it's probably worth it. We'd be remiss if we didn't spend a bit of time talking about Market Street, which I think was a very far-sighted idea, and probably one which came across quite a bit of resistance because, of course, it takes up slightly more space than is strictly necessary. So people who are absolutely devoted to sweating every square foot probably opposed it, I'm guessing. But tell me the story behind it.
Well, I think you told the genesis of the story brilliantly well there. 125 years ago this year, Morrisons was born. From market stall to market street over the last 125 years is definitely something we'll be celebrating this year. And you're right, we have, as a business, as a brand, Morrisons has remained very committed to market street over that time when it may have been easier to, and indeed some of our competitors may have withdrawn from that proposition in the marketplace. And really for us, that's about being true to what is distinctively Morrisons in our heritage and in our DNA. And in one of the most competitive grocery markets in the world, making sure that we have something that is true to Morrisons, that is valued by customers and by our colleagues, and that we can deliver week in, week out. But yes, it takes up space. Yes, it can be more expensive to run, but we believe it is genuinely a compelling, motivating reason for customers to choose Morrisons. And so we're very proud to continue backing Market Street and hopefully for the next 125 years.
Because as a sort of behavioural science nerd, I particularly like the idea that it changes the appearance of the store when you come in, making it seem more spacious. There's a similar trick with a Boeing 787, interestingly, where they make the little entry area where you first come through the door disproportionately spacious, because that effect effectively carries over to your experience of the rest of the plane psychologically. And I suppose the other thing about Market Street is that it actually anticipated really what was a much wider trend. I've just come back from a farmer's market this afternoon near Deal. And actually people seem to be returning to and hearkening after exactly that mode of shopping once again. I mean, there was a period in my childhood where supermarkets tried to look almost like chemists. You know, food was displayed in a really clinical way, often behind glass or in chilled cabinets. And this is actually seems to be, you seem to actually have spotted a trend which was already there, where people actually rather like, particularly food, they like that feeling of earthiness and authenticity.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, of course, efficiency and convenience has been a big driving force of change in many industries, in grocery retail, no exception to that in recent years. But whilst on the one hand, the Market Street proposition absolutely resonates with the kind of what might be seen as the core or traditional Morrisons customer, the older customers who've been shopping that Market Street with that butcher in that local store for decades, it's also really resonating with younger customers now. We're seeing those who are going to buy their meat from a butcher or their fish from a fishmonger each weekend. And that's partly provenance, that's partly quality, that's partly expertise, and that sense of supporting a local community. And that's something that Morrisons, I think, does do uniquely well. You described the size of the business. We are a huge business, and you described that at the start of this session. But we do still feel like, at our best, we do feel like we're part of the local communities in which we work, and that makes Morrisons a magical place to work.
And also, of course, you mentioned the expertise. You know, a fishmonger who knows about fish, a cheesemonger who knows about cheese. There's also just the pleasure of having people and interacting with people, which I think is probably coming back into fashion to a degree. Although in a large number of your competitors, I would argue, Booth's is an exception. They've kind of almost reverted exclusively, I think, to man's tills. Booth's, for the benefit of pansy Southerners, is another chain largely known up north. But the extent to which even sort of fairly premium grocery retailers are pushing people towards self-checkout seems to have slightly overreached itself. I mean, not only with an epidemic of shoplifting, of course, which seems to have resulted, but also increasingly I notice consumers effectively pushing back. There are fundamental practical problems. You can't do a trolley shop and self-checkout, really, can you? I mean, you're going to get an awful lot of unidentified objects in the bagging area if you try and do that. So that strikes me as a sort of cost-cutting measure which looks clever, but might actually backfire quite badly, I think.
I think it, for us, it comes down to trying to empower customers with choice. And the reality is there are some customers who want to do a big trolley shop, want to go through a traditional checkout, have a conversation with a colleague. And there are some who want to be in and out as quickly as possible. Small, you know, we've seen a move towards much smaller baskets in recent years and more frequent shops, and be able to get through that entire experience with minimal human contact. And then there's every interaction desire in between that. And of course, as human beings, we aren't consistent either. We want different things at different times. So for us, the drive is to empower customers with choice. Clearly what we have to get right, and there's no blueprint model for this in the office, this has to be getting it right in every individual store, is the mix of the self-checkout versus the traditional checkout, and listening to customers and to colleagues when we get that wrong, which we do, and we would regularly listen to that feedback and go back in and change the model in a given store.
And go back and change it back. Yeah, because I hear that McDonald's is opening 100 outlets. Now, this may be a test in their defense. It may simply be a test with no actual manned tills. So in other words, all ordering has to happen on screen. And their case for this is that 50% of people already order on screen. And it struck me that, okay, 50% isn't really quite enough. I mean, we can all risk pissing off 2% of our customers, perhaps, but 50% if they have a strong preference for ordering in person, or they simply have a question, after all, okay,
yeah,
you know, which a screen can't answer. That seems to me, unless it's part of a test, which wouldn't be unreasonable, it seems to me slightly overreaching yourself, I think, there. I mean, you can always fantasize about this perfectly efficient transaction, you know, which involves no human contact. People give you money, they take the goods away. But actually, you know, for reasons of temperament and circumstance, you know, you're never going to get more than a certain percentage of your transactions happening that way, unless you risk effectively alienating so many of your customers that it's not a price worth paying, I think.
Yeah. Our job is to listen to and respond to and try to predict, based on that listening, what customers want next, not to force them down a route that self-serves for the business.
No, all credit to that. I mean, one other thing that probably isn't sufficiently understood in, among Southerners here, Deal in Kent, so it's about as far south as you can go. The extent to which you're actually quite vertically integrated, so you own farms, you produce your own meat. Obviously, your origins were as a butter and egg merchant, but actually more than I think the other supermarkets, you actually produce what you sell. And famously, of course, you are completely unaffected by the the horse meat crisis. Morrison's was the one supermarket, I think, which escaped completely unscathed from any kind of intimation that there was horse meat in the food.
Yeah.
Partly because of that.
Yeah, you're right. Partly because of our vertically integrated model, our manufacturing business, the closeness that gives us to our supply chain, our ability to confidently respond when questions like the horse meat scandal are asked. But that part of our business proposition remains, again, very important. Morrison's, you may have read, we brought in a new CEO recently. That CEO has been very clear on explaining that we are a new chapter in the same story of Morrison's, and Market Street and our manufacturing business remain absolutely core to who we are and what we stand for. And our job, my job in particular, I guess, as Chief Customer Marketing Officer, is to make sure that we understand how those strategic or business model choices are driven by and translate into customer benefit.
Yes, I mean, it's always worth reminding people of that, because it's a point of difference which can very easily get lost. But I think, increasingly, we've survived in some cases, I think. People assume that brands actually make the things they brand. And, that thing, which is still true, of course, in some cases. But I think, quite a lot of brands have actually traded under that illusion for rather too long. And possibly there's a limit to how long you can get away with it. It's different slightly with retailer brands. Obviously, you're not going to make everything, although Marks and Spencer's kind of once tried, I guess. But at the same time, I think it's not an unreasonable assumption that if you put your name on something, that you are actually responsible for it in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. And customers will put their trust in your brand name. So if something carries your brand name, then whether you made it yourself or not, you have to be sure that you have overseen the production, the quality standards to meet the expectations of your customers. As I say, whether it's directly manufactured by you, like much of our produce is, or whether it's made by somebody else, but ultimately under the umbrella and guardianship of your brand name.
Tell me more. I mean, one other area where you're very interesting, because obviously in some respects you're seen as traditional, but actually your partnership with Amazon is pretty innovative. You're a supplier to Amazon, to their fresh stores. And I think you're a supplier to them for, I always get slightly confused between, obviously you have fresh can mean two things. It can mean the physical stores and there's a delivery component. How does that partnership work and how did it begin?
We have a strategic partnership with Amazon. And as you say, one of the things that, again, lots of people don't realize is that when you order groceries online from Amazon, that is Morrison's who is providing and fulfilling that order. And that really started as a way of expanding Morrison's reach. We are a predominantly, physical footprint-wise, predominantly northern-based retailer, by no means exclusively, but predominantly. And we were a bit later to the party on launching and scaling our online proposition, which we did then rapidly do during the pandemic. The partnership with Amazon was about really getting the Morrison's brand into more postcodes and more households around the country. And it's proven very successful, continues to be a key part of how we reach customers and how we grow with customers.
Tell us more about the loyalty program. I understand there's a very clever thing which is almost akin to people my age, BT's Friends and Family, where you can nominate specific brands that you particularly like and gain, effectively, I think you gain extra points when you buy them. Is that right?
Yeah, so we've been, to be a bit X factor about it, we've been on a journey with the loyalty scheme over recent years. The business made a decision a few years ago to effectively retire the previous loyalty scheme and launch something in its place, but without really having the means to deliver that for customers in a way that they would value and appreciate. And the loyalty scheme, therefore, went from being a reason to shop at Morrison's to, through loss aversion terms, having taken something away and almost forcing a reappraisal of where to shop at a time when competitors were strengthening their loyalty programs and other parts of their customer proposition. So we've been working very hard over the last couple of years to reawaken loyalty at Morrison's, working with a great team of people and great partners. And in May of last year, we launched, I'll call it the new More Card scheme. It was always called the More Card scheme.
More Card. Yeah.
But it was asleep for a while. I say we resurrected it and launched it, really trying to take the very best of the old MoreCard scheme that we know that customers and colleagues had genuinely missed the ability to earn points on their shop, on their fuel, to earn fivers, £5 vouchers that they can save up and spend on next week's shop, or save up and spend to get a material discount off a big shop like the Christmas shop.
Yeah, that's interesting. Or sort of, or what's quite useful about that is, in some ways, people like those currencies because it's guilt-free indulgence, isn't it?
Exactly.
You know, yeah. You can buy things with points, which you're less comfortable about buying with pure money.
Yeah.
I always make this point to economists by pointing out that, you know, that there are many cases where vouchers are actually more valuable than cash because they're less painful to spend. So yeah, that's interesting.
And of course, in grocery retail, where every pound is so hardly fought in such a competitive industry, every item in basket, every trade up is so valuable to us as a retailer. So the points and the fivers were iconic from the previous versions of the loyalty scheme. At the same time, we want a contemporary loyalty scheme that works for today and that genuinely builds two-way loyalty. It is, of course, about making the customers more loyal to Morrisons, not just on the next shop, but on 10 shops later, by also showing them that we have loyalty to them. And that means being much more data-driven at its heart, and by no means digital only, but more digital capability and engagement and gamification in the scheme. So what we launched tried to take the very best of the old and combine it with the new and the contemporary. And whilst there's been a number of changes to the customer-facing proposition, the bringing back of the points and fivers, the introduction of some loyalty price mechanics, some personalised offers. But then whilst we've been making those changes to the customer-facing proposition and breathing life back into the scheme, we've been having to work incredibly hard on all the infrastructure and the ecosystem that sits behind that, both from a people perspective, a data plumbing perspective, a marketing technology perspective. There's been a huge amount of work going on, and almost every week it feels like we make progress through a milestone that means we can really deliver what I believe will be a compelling and rewarding loyalty scheme to customers. And then my points boosters that you reference would be one of the more recent manifestations of that, where, as you say, we are working with a partner to take customer shopping behavior from the previous 12 months. We really understand what brands and categories they like to shop. And then we offer them the ability to earn points and milestones of points through gamified challenges on particular brands and categories. And it's in early days where we are testing, we're in trial mode, but the response from customers has been overwhelmingly positive in terms of what they say about it, in terms of how they're engaging with and perceiving the loyalty scheme, and in their actual voting with their feet response, where we're seeing the sales uplifts. And it's a great way, of course, of involving our branded partners as well, because often when you work in a marketing department in a supermarket, you're very focused on your brand and your own brand products. And that absolutely remains my number one priority. But alongside something distinctive like Market Street, a big reason that customers will choose to come and shop at Morrisons is because of the nation's favorite brands that we sell. And so being able to help those brands reach our customers and our customers shop with those brands that they love is a win-win-win for everybody involved.
No, and also, of course, it probably, first of all, it has a higher perceived value, I think, when discounts are specific to you. In other words, personalized discounts have a higher perceived value than generalized discounts. I think that's just how the mind works. Also, I think there's something ingenious in that if you get extra points on your favorite brands, i.e. those you buy most frequently, you're going to feel slightly silly buying them somewhere else. So that's rather a very, very clever mechanic. The other thing, of course, with loyalty programs, which I really like about them, which is a benefit to the consumer, which I think often gets missed. I was talking to Ocado about this, is that they, obviously Ocado knows everything everybody buys. They don't actually need that kind of program. But they said they make a very big distinction between things that a few people buy occasionally. And there are also items which don't sell particularly well in volume terms, but the people who buy them a hell of a lot. And they're very, very wary about delisting those because if you know, if you're not careful, you lose someone's entire shop. If they're going elsewhere to buy their favorite cheese or their favorite whatever it may be. And I think supermarkets probably made that mistake in the past before they had loyalty programs. They looked at the overall sales of things and thought they were unexciting. You know, I mean, in an extreme case, I was Angostura bitters. OK, you know, most people never buy them. A few people buy them very occasionally. But if you're a pink gin fanatic, you probably buy it, you know, I don't know, like, you'd be pretty heavy, but, you know, once every 2 months or something. And so spotting that distinction between things that just aren't selling very much and things that aren't selling that much, but to certain people are really decisive, I think is one of the ways in which loyalty programs really, really help. Actually, they help niche manufacturers as well, but they also help, you know, consumer preference, I think.
Absolutely. The purpose and benefit of a loyalty scheme isn't just in the driving the sales week in, week out and trying to bank the stickiness of the sale and via the loyalty scheme in the future. It is ultimately how a retailer like Morrisons should be refining and improving its proposition. And that can absolutely be on the core fundamentals of the shopping trip, whether it's Angostura bitters or whether it's broccoli. If I've gone into my shop that day and there's something that I need, if I can't get it, that is the most frustrating part of the shopping experience. And there's lots that's very complex and data-driven and fascinating about the grocery retail industry. And there's lots that's brass tacks as well. And still, the number one driver of satisfaction with the shopping trip would be availability. Because if you go in and you can't get what you're looking for, that time has been wasted. And then to the retailer, the risk is, of course, that you lose the whole basket. And that if you do that often enough, and the often enough will vary by customer, that you might not just lose the whole basket, you might lose the whole customer. And as I said, in such a competitive industry where every item in the basket, every pound through the till, every customer visit counts so much, kind of mess with that at your peril.
By the way, it's something where supermarkets have become inordinately better. I'm old, so I can remember where, you know, you would routinely go on a supermarket trip and, you know, there would be, you know, three empty chunks of a shelf where everything had sold out. And the extent to which they preserve availability now, and indeed through the pandemic, I thought it was, you know, I'm not suggesting we should have gone outside and clapped for, you know, retailers, but it was an extraordinary achievement in a sense, you know, that is a sort of logistical achievement. I suspect my kids don't really appreciate this because they've never really grown up in a world where you had sort of routine scarcity. But it is really, really remarkable. I'd love to know, by the way, how do people divide, roughly speaking, between the people who spend their fivers as they get them and the people who save up for a splurge? Because I'd be really interested to know the ratio of that, because there's a very interesting kind of thing in economics where you divide people. You know, people have actually quite different attitudes towards money in that way. And there's a kind of treat mindset and a scarcity mindset. What's the rough ratio without giving away trade secrets?
Well, it's too soon to say for this this chapter, the loyalty scheme, let's say, because we're just coming up to our first birthday party. But if it were to follow what we've seen in the past, it would have been around 85% saving up and redeeming on a big shop, a treat, an event like Christmas, and 50% redeeming as they go.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I would have put it at kind of 60-40, but it was sort of 80-20, effectively had a kind of Christmas club mentality to it.
Yeah, like you say, historically, and that's not in times of the cost of living crisis or the prevalence of these schemes across the industry. So I myself actually am fascinated to see how much that has changed. We've only traded one Christmas under the new scheme. We did see a huge volume of customers save up and redeem their fivers at Christmas. We saw something similar to a slightly lesser extent at Easter. It doesn't at the moment seem to be quite as extreme a distinction as it was in the past, but a little bit too early to call, perhaps.
It's good, of course, that people do that, because if you have people redeeming on extravagances, they tend to be redeeming, I suppose, on slightly higher margin goods, which doesn't hurt. I know there was a sort of thing with the Boots Advantage card. What you hoped would happen was that they'd redeem on perfume, for example, rather than redeeming on sandwiches. I think the perceived fun value, you mentioned gamification, the kind of fun value of a loyalty program comes out of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, the other thing that we that was the big change in bringing points back in this new scheme is that it's not a, what we would call in the industry, a base currency. So it's not that for every pound you spend across the store, you earn a certain number of points. We do have that on fuel. That is important on some in some areas. But in the kind of core shop grocery shopping trip, you earn points on certain products or categories. And so at launch, for example, because we coincided the launch of the new Morecard scheme with the launch of the new Morrisons brand platform, which also was a resurrection, which was more reasons to shop at Morrisons.
Yes.
And an effort really to highlight Market Street. Because if we're still in Market Street, to go back to where we started this conversation, then we have to make sure that customers understand, are aware, and appreciate what Market Street gives them as a reason to shop at Morrisons. And so points are largely earned at the moment around the perimeter of the store, around Market Street products, or showcasing the best premium tier own brand range. So we are able then to use points as a strategic tool,
yes,
to encourage and incentivize customers to engage with parts of the proposition that matter to us either perennially or at a particular moment in time. Now, again, of course, you have to balance that with it being appealing enough and high volume enough to allow customers to earn points,
yeah,
at a frequency that they deem sufficient. But I think that gives us great flexibility, which we wouldn't have if, like many other schemes, we still had that base currency with a lot of auto reward and inefficiency attached to it.
So actually, by being a slightly late entrant into this, or by at least resurrecting this, you've actually avoided some of the pitfalls, I think, which have been made. I mean, as you said, the base level £1, 1 point thing isn't really, that's not really leveraging the potency of a loyalty scheme to the extent. It's rather like having an airline loyalty scheme, which is just miles flown. That's not really the point. And so you have, and also I think the fiver thing. I think it's shrewd keeping that because it's kind of concrete.
Exactly.
In other words, it's a real thing, and you actually get something tangible with a sufficient frequency that it keeps you motivated.
Exactly.
So. I'm fascinated. I mean, loyalty program design absolutely fascinates me because it's so interesting. And actually, I think many of the earlier programs were kind of constrained by what was technologically possible or whatever. And so actually, in some cases, by being a late entrant, you may have actually allowed yourself to produce something much, much more efficacious, I think.
I hope so. And I'm an eternal optimist. So in being late to the party, we have an opportunity not just to catch up, but to leapfrog. In certain places. And, we did misstep on the loyalty scheme. And so we went through the pain of having removed the scheme and that base currency that came with it. So I don't want to suggest that it was all by design. We did suffer the consequences of that. But that did then put us in a position, having lived through that pain, to make the right choices about what scheme to bring forward in a way that would work for the business and for our customers.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Two Challenges, brought to you by ALF Insight.
ALF Insight helps media owners, agencies and marketing service providers improve their new business pipelines by equipping them with in-depth insights, accurate information and daily news updates on the leading and challenger brands in the UK. ALF now also helps sports clubs, venues and charities win new partnership deals. ALF Insight identifies the brands to target at the right time, providing everything you need to tailor the perfect pitch. Visit ALF Insight, that's ALFinsight.com, or click the link in the episode description to find out more. So we've got a little section here, which is, we always have, it's a sort of regular weekly feature called Top Two Challenges. And they're really one challenge, but you answer it in a way that's specific to Morrison's and to the supermarket sector as a whole. So the question is, what's the key challenge for Morrison's in particular, you see, going forward? And what's the big challenge for the wider grocery multiple sector in its entirety?
Look, I think the biggest challenge for the sector and for Morrison's in the sector, and I'm repeating myself a little bit, is that it's just such a highly competitive industry. It's, you know, we're a small island with lots of customers, lots of choice on where to get your calories from. Because it's not, we're not just competing for supermarket shops, we're competing on calories. And within supermarkets, I talked about, you know, you are kind of fighting for every visit, every pound, every item in the basket. On average, people shop at over four different supermarkets, and that's a choice that they make, visit in, visit out. So it's so highly competitive. And for Morrison's, we're really in the middle, in the squeeze middle of that industry. We're not the market leader, but we're not the challenger or the discounter. And so to find your space in that market and to be able to stick to that space, and to be able to zag when it's time to zag as well, if that makes sense. We've kind of got to meet everyone else at the party, but have a dress that makes us look special. And for us, really doubling down on Market Street, doubling down on cafes, doubling down on our community champions, our links to the local community, our manufacturing business and vertically integrated model, and what that means for the freshness we can offer, or our commitment to British farming. We really have to make sure, I think the challenge for any business that's squeezed in the middle is, be clear on what makes you different and distinctive, but not at any cost. Like, make sure it is valuable to customers and give customers the value from that choice. If you're choosing to operate in a slightly different way, that doesn't make you win in and of itself. You might be different, but you might not be compelling. So we have to remain, I think, very humble in that respect, and constantly listening to customers and translating what we believe makes Morrison special into what customers believe makes Morrison special and worth a visit.
So from your experience there, working in the supermarket sector for many years, it's obviously complicated. You mentioned this, more reasons to shop at Morrison's effectively covers this. But the motivating factors, you have price matching offers, loyalty cards, store location, convenience and brand loyalty, would all be fairly big factors. I mean, probably brand loyalty is a bigger factor in the UK than in many countries, actually. Someone said this, that they said that, you know, what you have to understand is, you know, American or German retail is almost all about price, and British retail is much more about brand. How do you see that mixture? Because, you know, how do you see that mixture evolving over time?
Well, I think it keeps you very humble. And stops you being complacent, because first of all, when you talk about drivers of choice, it's not something that happens on an annual basis. You don't sit down and review your supermarket of the year and decide where you're going to shop for the next 365 days. No. That choice is made almost every single day. And still, the biggest driver of choice is convenience of location.
Yeah.
And so you can have a customer who's incredibly loyal to a particular supermarket, let's say Morrison's, very bought into the proposition, very connected to their local store, great value for money, loves the service, and. But there'll still be times that customer will shop somewhere else because they're traveling back from their mother-in-law's and had to pop in and get some milk urgently or whatever it might be. So that makes it, that keeps you very humble, and it makes you have to, as I said a few times, compete very hard for every customer and every visit and every item in the basket. But beyond that, it tends to be range and value for money. But then, of course, value for money is it is price, but it's so much more than price as well. Within price, it's base prices, the prices I can trust every day, as well as promotional prices, as well as what I feel like I get as value from the loyalty scheme. It's the quality element of that as well, and the service experience. So it's hard to pull apart those different drivers of choice and of satisfaction, because they largely combine, I think, in a human being's mind as to one very complex input, simple outputs, value for money equation. Definitely loyalty schemes have played a bigger role in recent years, I would say, but probably more because they're feeding back into those evergreen truths around what makes for a decision to visit one supermarket or another for a particular mission or event or occasion, around price and around feeling that the value you get is fair. And then availability, we talked about availability being absolutely core to the proposition. And then, of course, brand strength, brand loyalty, emotional engagement with the brand absolutely comes into it. And that can be at a macro level. Like, what do people think of Tesco versus a Morrisons versus an Aldi? What do they think of? But I think it's also very much at a local level. And one of the things that I love the most about working for Morrisons, having worked for other supermarkets and I've worked in financial services, but on the retail banking side, one of the best things about Morrisons is, despite being 125 years old, we do still feel very much like a family business. Yes. And we do operate at the heart of our communities. And we have, in every single store, for example, we have a community champion, and their sole job is to be integrated in the local community, supporting schools or charities or people who need it, fundraising, selling pickup packs for local food banks. So that's something that I think you still get that slightly... There's an authenticity, I think, to a Morrison. So
is it still family-owned, in fact? Large majority family-owned?
No.
No. So it is actually a PLC?
It's private equity-owned.
It's private equity-owned. Oh, interesting. Okay, interesting. But actually, you seem to have fairly benign owners, because quite often, I think, a lot of those things, investment in reputation in the community and so forth, they pay off enormously, but it's very hard to prove. And, you know, one of the things that's exercising me more and more is, I think marketers kind of went along with this technology myth that actually one day there'll be a day where you know the value of every pound you spend on marketing, and somehow you know it instantaneously, which strikes me, it strikes me as a completely false god, actually. But marketers kind of went along with the pretense because they didn't want to look to be dragging their heels. But at some level, it's simply not true. You know, your links with a local community, actually, they're valuable in multiple different ways, and it's impossible to disentangle the different ways in which they pay back and to attribute a precise kind of ROI value on these things. And I think we're setting, in some cases, I knew this because I started in direct marketing. And the great thing about direct marketing was you could measure, and it was fantastic, and you learned extraordinary things through measurement. But the only downside is you were never allowed to do anything that you couldn't measure. And so, you know, if you suggested something perfectly sensible, why don't you send your best customers a Christmas card? Because that was actually either impossible to measure its effect or very, very slow. Because, of course, all loyalty information is actually very, very slow to emerge by its very nature. Because I think that, you know, we've had probably underinvestment in brand advertising, but much worse, we've had underinvestment in customer service. Because the value of customer service and customer contact and human connection is actually much more, you know, if you don't do brand advertising, you undoubtedly miss an opportunity. I'm not suggesting people shouldn't. But in some cases, I think the underinvestment in customer service is causing a kind of crisis of trust, particularly in, I think, the digital economy, where people are kind of once bitten, twice shy. They've had three disastrous experiences where you can't get hold of a human being to solve a problem. I nearly had one this morning. I think there was a statistic. There's, I think it was an organization called The Foundation who produced a piece on customer service where they said that something like 2 in 5 people have been enraged by something in the last month.
Wow.
And, you know, that's I think that's a brewing problem for a lot of these companies who've very conveniently outsourced a lot of work to their own customers by making them do all the, effectively all the typing has to be done yourself. No. Okay.
We're all very committed to making the very best of what is the very best of Morrisons.
Yes.
and the investment into the loyalty scheme, the investment into brand advertising, the focus on week in, week out, understanding how customers are assessing all parts of the shopping trip, including helpfulness of colleagues, friendliness of colleagues. In more recent months, a real focus on reducing customer complaints, which through a weekly process led from the very, very top of the business, sponsored by the CEO, chaired by myself, we've seen a reduction of nearly 50% in complaints.
Tell me more about that. This is fascinating because my last guest on the show was from BT, EE actually, as they're now called, the consumer division of BT. And the one thing I said to him was, I said, you know, I don't think we're ever going to live in a world where people write paeans of praise to their utilities, okay? But one thing I had noticed over recent years is that people don't complain about BT as they once did. It's just, it's no longer a conversation, whereas once it was a kind of staple. And one of the things they said, which I thought was really interesting, is effectively they very much focused on solving a problem there and then. In other words, the real disasters are the problems that drag on and on, or that require three phone calls, or that, you know, require you to wait halfway, you know, before your problem is solved. And they focused very much on effectively solving every problem in the moment. And that seems to have really paid off for them, because it occurred to me that actually, consumers aren't complete assholes, okay? They accept that companies make mistakes or that things go wrong. You know, I had a very weird experience on social media where people were going bananas with because their Ocado delivery didn't turn up. And people were pointing out that actually their distribution center had burned down. And so these were extenuating circumstances, you know. But at the same time, they're not completely unreasonable. Everybody will give you the benefit of the doubt. But if you have three bad experiences in a row, which is, you know, you order your goods online, they don't arrive, then you contact the retailer and they tell you you have to contact the distribution company, which you didn't even choose, okay? Yeah. And then you can't get hold of the distribution company. Those are the things which really spiral into kind of fury and rage. And I think, because I think we often don't look at that. We look at the average satisfaction of a particular interaction. But the fact is that three bad interactions in a row, or, you know, requiring three interactions to solve a problem, is what's really, really at the heart of the problem, I think.
Yeah.
I'd be really intrigued. Tell me more about this, because it was sponsored from the top, and it was effectively, okay, when we have complaints, what do we do? And
Exactly. So I'll tell the story in a second. But of course, what you just described, the converse of if you have had a bad experience, you do complain. If that can be positively, quickly, well resolved, then you end often from a behavioral economics perspective, your perception of the business, the brand, is higher than before you encountered the issue in the first place. So it is a real opportunity to turn a pain point into a golden moment with a customer.
Oh no, I've had actually complaints where the resolution of the complaint leaves me ecstatic.
Exactly.
The last two were a very, very nerdy thing about connecting my Ford app to my car, which was unbelievably nerdy as a problem. But obviously, you know, they have call center staff who've obviously been there a long time and know about everything, which really matters, I think. Longevity of call center staff. And the second one was actually Zoom. There was a very niche tech problem I was experiencing on Zoom, where I was so impressed by how quickly they understood the problem and how quickly they solved it that I actually left, as you said, much, much more committed to them. Because I suppose what it is that's how you test. It's one thing to measure a customer's loyalty to a business, but a business's loyalty to its own customers is really only put to the test when something goes wrong.
Absolutely. And our focus has been, so every Monday morning at Morrison's at 8 a.m., we will gather our most senior team together and we'll review the complaints from the week before across every area of the business. And the objective is twofold. One is to resolve each complaint for each customer. But really, of course, that's the job of the customer service team and the contact center. That's not going to be solved for however many customer complaints in a two-hour meeting on a Monday morning. But really getting to the root cause and understanding what's driving the complaints and then committing to root cause solving those so that neither that customer nor any other customer in the future needs to contact us again about that issue because they haven't experienced it.
Because nobody... So interestingly, that's very much akin to what happens in the airline industry and airline safety, which is you report, in other words, rather than people disguising problems, you're encouraged to report them, and then something is put in place so that it never recurs.
Exactly.
This is airline industry safety approach. This is fabulous. I mean, this is absolutely fabulous. Go on, give me a few of the weirder complaints you've had just for our listeners.
Well, I mean, first of all, like you say, like customers don't complain unless they really feel that they need or have to. And even in an extenuating circumstance like a distribution center burning down, if that means that you haven't received the sandwich platter that you'd ordered for your daughter's christening, then that is really disappointing and really frustrating.
Yes.
And the emotional impact of that is much more significant than the just on paper one delivery didn't happen. So I would take, you know, we take them all very, very seriously, and we try to understand the wider context and implications of any complaint. But we've learned so much. We've learned around, and we try to get as granular as possible to understand if our complaints have been driven by certain regions or times of day or delivery routes. You know, we get really granular to try and root solve in a granular and effective way. But those complaints can be anything around from behavioural service. And I must say as well, we do also actually receive compliments on behavioural
yes.
service, which is fantastic. And that anybody, any customer in this day and age taking the time to let a business know that they've received yeah. excellent service from a human being who's working really, really hard day in, day out, that's magic. I think that still happens.
I think you've got a methodology here you could actually sell to other organizations, because there was a piece in the FT recently basically entitled "How Did Customer Service Get So Bad?" And this methodology which you've got seems absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, not really credit to our new CEO. He pioneered this from his first day in the business. I think we implemented the new process on week two of his tenure. And at the start of that process, you can look and think, is this going to make a difference? We, you know, of course, we receive a fair number of complaints. We have 10 million transactions a week, 10 million customer visits. So,
well, yeah.
So one of my highlights of the last 6 months, one of the things I'm most proud of on behalf of my team and the business is the impact we've had on the customer experience through that very data-led, very results-focused lack of ego and commitment to making things better that has led to such a material reduction in complaints and an improvement in our satisfaction scores.
It's kind of an obsession of mine, because I think the one mistake marketers generally make in their approach to things is they're always looking to add positives, and the bigger return comes from removing negatives, in fact.
Yes, absolutely. A complaint is an obstacle to a sale.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And actually, it can be, you know, as you said, you can lose a customer over it. You've got call centers, fairly large call centers, I imagine.
We do, but that was another big change that we made up until relatively recently. Until last summer, we had an in-house contact center operation.
Yeah.
And it was in the office in Bradford. And there were lots of positives and advantages to that, not least the connectedness to the business. But we decided to outsource that operation. It was a big decision to make. It's not one that we made lightly. But I think that the results that we've seen since have helped to show that it was the right decision to make. And it also professionalizes the operation and means that we can do more with the insight that we get now, so that the contact center becomes not just a place for customers to let us know about problems they've had and for us to try to resolve, but to generate and shape insight and feed it into the business in a way that helps us to improve the proposition for
really interesting
days and weeks and months ahead.
And you've made sure with the call centers, obviously, because, I mean, there was a very interesting comment from a consultant I met once who said he had a very simple sort of rule as to whether a company was customer focused, which was whether call center staff were empowered to call out rather than just receive calls. And he said it was almost a sort of fail-safe rule, that places where someone could call the customer back to apologize, to give additional information, to you know, to provide a final solution, to check that the solution had worked. He said, generally, those were magnificent customer-focused businesses. The ones where you were only allowed to sit there and answer inbound calls were not.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting kind of rule, that, I think.
I completely agree with that. And also, we'd be lost without it, because if something goes wrong with customers' fivers, we need to be able to get in touch with them and let them know before they experience disappointment. To take that as
of course.
And I'll say that mantra for us is true for in-store colleagues as well. It's not just about the call centre.
Yes.
We want our colleagues to feel empowered to say yes to the customer and to know, you know, within the realms of safe and legal, that if they say yes to the customer, as a business, we'll always back them and support them.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, that's fantastic. Tell me a bit more about the cafes, by the way, because that's a really interesting component now. And my local Sainsbury's has gone full in on a kind of weird food court model. Where they have, I think, Gourmet Burger Kitchen, Slim Chickens. They have about three sort of effective sort of franchise model. To be honest, it's upstairs, which isn't the cleverest place to put it, because I think you'd be better off putting it somewhere where people can see. But nonetheless, it's interesting as an experiment. There is a name for it. Is it Sainsbury's Food Hub? It might be. I was wondering if you've got any specific plans for the cafes.
I think a bit like the conversation we had around the right balance of self-checkout and traditional man-checkout tills, we have to take quite a localized approach and make sure that we know what will work in every given supermarket. But our cafes remain quite traditional cafes across the majority of our supermarkets. We did experiment a few years ago with making some changes to the menu, and, you know, smashed avocado on toast only did so well with the Morrison's customer. And there were things that we took off the menu that we had to
Blame them, actually. It's slightly overrated, let's be honest, isn't it? You know,
taking fried bread off the menu didn't go down very well in some of our supermarkets. So
quite right. No, yeah. Sorry. The loss of fried bread to the full English breakfast is a disgrace. It's this American invader, the hash brown, is like the kind of grey squirrel of the breakfast world.
So I think knowing that our cafes are cafes, right? They're traditional cafes. The value for money is extraordinary. And again, whilst Morrison's, much like any supermarket, serves customers of all demographics, attitudes, life stage, household status, affluence, you know, we serve the length and breadth of modern Britain. And that is one of the most joyous things about working for a brand like Morrison's, that anybody has the right to walk through your doors and be served well. Whilst that's true, and we have customers of all shapes and sizes coming through the doors, we do have a slight over-index in a slightly older, slightly less affluent customer. And for that customer, the cafe proposition is really appealing and important.
And in terms of that sociability, one of the things that worries me about increasingly swanky eating habits is that actually it's a limit to sociability. Because if you take four retirees, you know, two of them are going to be more affluent than the other two. And, you know, those kind of cafes where everybody can afford to eat well together, regardless of their disposable income, is actually really, really important. You know, pubs have become less democratic, haven't they? You know, historically, pubs were this place which were, you know, kind of pretty much open to all, and nobody was really excluded. And that's something that worries me. I mean, you know, there are lots of good stories about food becoming much better and more experimental and so forth. But there is a risk to the whole thing as well.
Absolutely. And to your earlier point, of course, I have a responsibility to measure a lot of what can be measured, and to ensure that, you know, I may make the ultimate investment choice on a material budget on behalf of Morrison's, on behalf of our customers. So I do need to ensure that we are spending that responsibly and delivering for customers and for the business. But there are some things that are much harder to measure. And there may be a customer who comes into one of our cafes and nurses a cup of tea or a pot of tea for a few hours. And in that time, has some conversation, feels warm, and then maybe pops in to do their shop as well. And so be careful not to cut your nose off to spite your face by looking at parts of the proposition that might not on a face value seem like the most economically straightforward of decisions. You have to look at the holistic proposition and that how that customer, that human being is behaving. And of course, what they go home to say to their family or friends,
everybody else,
or carers, or whatever it might be. So the cafes are a really important part of the Morrison's business, and fried toast is back on the menu. And for any fish and chip lovers, I have to say, on a Friday, our fish and chips, I mean, I'm a Yorkshire girl, right? I'm very proud of and very particular about my fish and chips.
I think you should be more explicit about the Yorkshireness, actually. If I were doing your advertising, I'd go a bit rather like Yorkshire tea, if you like. I think there's an opportunity out there for actually to, you know, in other words, go full on. Because I think, you know, again, you know, as with I mentioned with Market Street, actually, you know, in a way you were ahead of the trend there. And I think, I think people, there's always a counter trend. That's the great thing I was taught. People always talk about trends, but they're actually kind of vectors, because there's always a counter trend going on at the same time. I mean, one last thing, by the way, I understand you've got on trolley advertising, which is digital. Is that right? That's coming in.
We've got trolley advertising, which isn't digital, which is one of those opportunities that I talked about before. That's really just helping, again, the right brands for our customers to have dwell time advertising space with customers as customers walk the shop. But we also have, which is unique to Morrisons, digital screens across Market Street. So you might be at the butcher's counter, for example, and on a digital screen, for argument's sake, let's imagine some sunny spring weather arrives and people are queuing up at the butcher's counter to get some beef burgers. And we might also be able to advertise or promote a beer or a seasoning for a steak, so that we are helping customers with the missions that matter in that moment, and helping brands, traditionally ambient brands, who've struggled to really connect with Market Street, to be there and present and relevant for customers at a time that makes sense. So Market Street being distinctive to Morrisons, these digital screens therefore being distinctive to Morrisons, just gives those brands an opportunity to connect in a way that they wouldn't be able to in other supermarkets.
I think and also it gives you an opportunity to sort of cross-sell across the store.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in a way that's relevant and feels right for the customer.
There are still some things about grocery retail which always strike me as really weird, which must date back literally, decades. For example, why sugar lumps are next to baking goods rather than next to tea and coffee? I've never made sense of that. And to me, washing machine stuff and dishwasher stuff is the same sort of stuff, and yet they're quite often in separate aisles. I just bracket them together. Your dishwasher cleaner, washing machine cleaner. Okay, you have fabric conditioner. No one's yet come out with a plate conditioner, but I'm sure Unilever are working on it. But it always strikes me there are some weird aspects to store layout which kind of defy logic. But
all very data led, I would say. Of course, based on the data of how you've operated in the past. So all retailers will have very, very clever customer decision hierarchies that inform that space planning. But you always have to make sure there's a good dose of common sense being applied.
Common sense alongside. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. I mean, Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a wonderful talk. You've been listening to On Brand with Alf and Rory Sutherland. As ever, if you want to do business with Morrisons or any other supermarket brand, you can contact the Alf Insight team on their website, which is www.alfinsight.com. That's www.alfinsight.com. And you can also find the link in the episode description. The series is produced and, as ever, expertly edited by Ultimate Content. And to make sure you receive the next episode, do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then tweak the algorithm in our favor by giving us a like. So thanks enormously for listening, and here's to next time.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.